Lecture 8, The Synoptic Problem and Its Solutions.
At long last, this course arrives at its real subject, the figure of Jesus, as it is configured in the ancient compositions called Gospels. It has been a long slog, but I hope the journey will have been worth it if we appreciate that the canonical Gospels in particular are not simply literary exercises carried out by individuals, but are rather literary expressions of community traditions. Indeed, the identity of the actual composers of the Gospels is one of the least known aspects of them. And here I remind you that it's important not to be deceived by those confident assertions that we find in the prefaces to the biblical books of the Bible that says this gospel was written by X at this year in that place to these people. The circumstances of the gospel's composition, the date, the author, the location, the audience, is entirely a matter of scholarly guesswork, about which there's virtually nothing that's certain. So in this session, I'm going to deal briskly with that question and then turn to one of the most fascinating questions concerning the canonical Gospels, namely the synoptic problem and its solutions. Let's begin with the question of how do we place these Gospels? Since the canonical Gospels are given titles in the manuscripts, the early handwritten versions of the Gospels that preceded printing, the good news according to X, the good news, to euangelion kata markon, to euangelion kata matthaion, and so forth. It's natural enough to ask about who were these authors and what were the circumstances in which they wrote. Now, there's two approaches to this question, the ancient approach and the contemporary approach. The ancient approach was through the names of the authors themselves, trying to identify who was Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And they did this by relying on traditions found in patristic or early Christian writings. For example, a second century figure named Papias, we only have fragments of his writings found in Eusebius of Caesarea's church history. This figure Papias averred that Matthew wrote first in the Hebrew dialect. Now, we're not sure what that meant. Hebrew dialect could mean classical Hebrew, it could mean Aramaic, and was later translated into Greek by others. And then Papias went on to state that Mark was a translation of Peter's preaching in Rome. Now, Mark gets connected to Peter because of the first letter of Peter, chapter 5, verse 12, which speaks of a Mark being with Peter as he wrote that letter, presumably from Rome. But let's remember that Mark is one of the most common names in the Roman Empire. Very unlikely that only one Christian is going to have the name Mark. And moreover, in the New Testament, Mark appears more often as a companion of Paul than of Peter. But let it be. In the 2nd century, or probably 2nd century, canonical list known as the Muratorian Canon, Luke is identified as a physician and a companion of Paul. And again, this is easily found to be based upon Paul's letter to the Colossians, chapter 4, verse 14, where he refers to Luke, the beloved physician, who is with him. And the Muratorian Canon identifies John as the beloved disciple of the fourth gospel. The gospel of John, beginning in chapter 13, 23, refers to one of the disciples, otherwise anonymous, as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And so he's come to be called the beloved disciple, who, this tradition goes on, is identified with John, the seer or the prophet, named in the book of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 4. Now, some scholars argue that this Muratorian canon is not from Rome in the 2nd century, but from Syria in the 4th century. I tend to think that it's second century Roman, but who cares? The point here is not its date and place, but the fact that it does try to connect these names in this fashion. Now, the problem with this approach is that identifications are based totally upon guesswork. In other words, they know a Mark connected with Peter. They know a Luke connected with Paul. And they have a strong apologetic interest. What is that apologetic interest? Connecting Gospels to apostles. Okay. So you want to get these Gospels under apostolic authority, even though obviously they weren't all written by apostles. So Matthew is regarded as Matthew the apostle, the follower of Jesus. John is regarded as John, the beloved disciple, the apostle. Mark is connected to Peter, the chief apostle. What could be better? And Luke is connected with Paul. This is an apologetic interest which is sufficiently transparent for us to recognize what's at work. It's a natural enough instinct to try to connect these stories to the big guys. But it's very important to note that even if these identifications were correct, they don't really help us in interpreting the Gospels. Take, for example, the tradition that Luke is a companion of Paul. He may have been. Or that he was a physician. He may have been. But it is bootless for us to try to interpret Luke's gospel as though only a physician could have written it. So people will look at the way in which Luke talks about sicknesses and fevers and say, we recognize Luke the physician there. Well, in fact, as a scholar named Henry J. Cadbury showed in a wonderful article called Luke and the Horse Doctors, Luke's actual vocabulary with regard to sickness is that not that of the trained medical technician, but the language of any well-educated person in antiquity. So, and furthermore, it would not tell us why Luke was concerned with certain things and so forth. So the identifications are guesswork. They don't help us with the interpretation, and they make even more acute the question of diversity in the accounts. John and Matthew are supposed to be eyewitnesses, and yet their gospels are the most diametrically different of the four canonical gospels. So the situation is not improved by making them eyewitnesses. The second approach is that followed by contemporary scholars, and it's through the literary and historical analysis of the compositions themselves. In other words, no presupposition is made that Luke is a specific figure or that John is a specific figure. Rather, we try to build up the circumstances of the writing in terms of social setting and themes and so forth, with very little attention to the identity of the actual authors. Sometimes this is pretty successful. Sometimes it's less successful. In any case, the reconstruction of the circumstances then becomes the framework for the interpretation of the gospel. Now, I'm going to suggest that in the case of the Gospel of Matthew, this works fantastically well. But in the case, for example, of Luke, I think it works less well. And there are problems with this approach, not least that of another form of circularity and guesswork. It's very tricky when we use a composition, say, it must have been written in these circumstances, and then we use those circumstances to interpret the composition. The circularity can be vicious. And partly because the evidence can point in several different directions and to several different kinds of settings. So that's all I'm going to say on this subject, except that we will try to provide a little bit of data with regard to the circumstances as best we can reconstruct them when we take the individual Gospels. Let's turn now to the real subject of this presentation, which is the synoptic problem. This is one of the most pressing problems facing the critical analysis of the canonical Gospels, namely the literary relationship of the Gospels according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Why not John? John's Gospel is so utterly different from the other three that it poses questions of its own, precisely because it is so different. But these three Gospels are alike and different in such intricate and complex ways that they present a specific kind of critical problem called synoptic. And the word synoptic simply means seen together, synopsis. And the dimension of the problem as well as its solution depends upon the Gospels actually being arranged in parallel columns. So in some sense, it's a problem which really only emerged with printing, when it became possible cheaply and effectively to line up the Gospels in columns in this fashion for purposes of comparison. Does this mean that ancient scholars were not aware that similar things were said in similar Gospels? Of course not. For example, Greek manuscripts are often marked by what are called Eusebian canons, numbers in the margins which indicate the other Gospels where a particular passage occurs. So they were aware of this. But remember that before printing and before individual reading, because of the expense of manuscripts, most everybody experienced the Gospels as they should be, that is, orally. They were read out loud and therefore were heard one by one in sequence from beginning to end, rather than in reading through a means of comparison. But nevertheless, this is the problem that we can see once we print them in columns and we can also begin to solve. What is the data? What do we need to consider here? It's very complex, and I beg your indulgence. You might have to play this tape over more than once. It's complex, and it involves three major categories: language, the selection of material, and the sequence, the order in which events occur. Let's begin with language. And here, you simply have to trust me, unless you read Greek yourself, because no English translation is going to show you what I'm talking about. You can see this only if you have the actual Greek text in front of you, and preferably if you have colored pencils and underline the phrases in this fashion. But we're not simply talking about similar language, we're talking about identity of language. And here's how it works. If we line up Matthew, Mark, and Luke for patches of phrases and individual words, sometimes the majority of a passage, they use the same words in the same sequence. But when they differ, Matthew and Luke differ differently. Okay? Something like having a freshman composition which is corrected by two different teachers. Okay? You keep the good words and the correct words, but you replace the other words, right? So that's what we have. It's a pattern of identity and difference rather than similarity and difference. Okay, so that's the language problem. The second problem is presented by the material found in these Gospels. And these are points 2 through 4 of your outline. About 90% of Mark's material is found in both Matthew and Luke, whereas about 10% of Mark is found in neither Matthew or Luke. I love this particular class because it's the only time in which I actually deal with hard data as opposed to fuzzy thoughts. Okay, so about 90% is found in both of the other versions, about 10% in neither. But Matthew and Luke also share a substantial amount of material, mainly sayings, not found in Mark. So Matthew and Luke have a body of material which they share. It's not in Mark. And in that body of material, we often find the same kinds of linguistic identity difference, you see. I talked earlier about the Lord's Prayer. It's found only in Luke and Matthew. It's not found in Mark. And the wording is, very similar with differences. Matthew and Luke also each have material unique to them, which we usually designate, in fairly obvious fashion, M material, Matthew, and L material, Luke. So this is a very complex set of observations. 90% of Mark is found in both, 10% in neither. Matthew and Luke share material that's not in Mark at all, and Matthew and Luke each have material that's not in any of the others. What do we do with this? Finally, the final aspect is order or sequence. Luke and Matthew differ in their sequence except where they both agree with Mark. Put it another way. When Matthew and Luke agree with Mark, they also agree with each other. Mark's narrative, what I call the Mark and spine, includes the story of Jesus from the baptism of John to the empty tomb. In that sequence, when one of the other Gospels follows Mark, the other one does as well. Now, if we go to the material before the baptism by John, the infancy accounts, Matthew and Luke share nothing. If we go to the material after the empty tomb, Matthew and Luke share nothing. And in the rest of the story, where they don't follow Mark, they don't agree with each other either. So how do we account for this? This is the synoptic problem. Language, selection of material, and sequence. And here is a situation in which popular, uncritical answers, the person in the pew answers, are clearly insufficient because they don't recognize the problem. You can't have an answer to a problem if you don't understand what the problem is. So a very folklorish kind of approach is teachers say similar things at different times. So Jesus, you know, would do the parable of the talents at one time and the parable of the pounds. And yes, teachers do repeat themselves. I can surely attest to that. But this does not cover the linguistic problem that we're talking about. The linguistic problem is of another order. Secondly, it is true that eyewitnesses can have different perspectives and versions. But the linguistic pattern does not fit that of eyewitness behavior. One thing is certain, if we are talking about eyewitness accounts in court, is that they will not use exactly the same words for some phrases and different words for others. If they do use exactly the same words, they're thrown out for purposes of collusion. So this is not the way in which eyewitnesses, and in fact, when I teach this course in a real classroom, I will often do some kind of silly thing at the beginning of class, which draws attention of the students, besides showing up, and then ask students to describe what it is that I did. Well, of course, the universal law is everybody gets it wrong, but even those who get the substance of it right never report the incident in the same kinds of terms. And an appeal to eyewitnesses, again, does not cover the circumstances in the first place. Why should the Gospel of Matthew, for example, have this long section of praise of Peter after Peter recognizes Jesus as the Messiah? Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. Why should Matthew's Gospel have that or know about that and not Mark, who was Peter's interpreter, supposedly? You know, it doesn't make sense. Why should John have none of the Sermon on the Mount if he's as equally an eyewitness as Matthew is? In fact, why should anybody know what Jesus said in prayer when he was by himself to the Father, or what Jesus said before the Sanhedrin, or what Jesus said before Pilate? In other words, this whole sort of very natural appeal to the sort of person in the pew folkloric account simply doesn't measure up because it doesn't see the problem. The data rather suggests, and indeed demonstrates, a literary relationship of dependence among these three Gospels. And all critical scholars agree that one of the Gospels was written first, and the others used it as a literary source for their versions. Okay, so we really are in a situation in which this dependence is not found at the level of the oral tradition, but at the written stage. This is the only way we can account for this, because there has to be fixity in language and so forth. And it is a beautiful example in which the approach called source criticism really works, because in this case, one of them really is the source for the others, and it's extant. So we can begin to try to figure out which one served as the source for the others. So it doesn't matter whether one is conservative, liberal, whatever one's ideological position is. Anybody who has any kind of critical training recognizes that the synoptic problem must be solved in terms of a written dependence of one gospel upon another. Now, one of the things that this suggests, of course, is that the early Christians, unlike many contemporary Christians, did not make the written text idolatrous, that they felt perfectly free to copy from another text and to alter it in one fashion or another. So we see here a remarkable freedom in the early years with regard to the memory of Jesus, even in its written form. So that when we talk about the composition of the Gospels as stabilizing the tradition, we don't mean petrifying the tradition. Now, there are two major hypotheses to solve the critical problem. The minority position today follows the ancient church tradition of Matthew's Gospel being written first. I say minority position. How minority? I would say perhaps 10 to 15% minority. It's a rather small minority. It makes up for its size, however, in the vigor and volume of its arguments. According to this theory, Matthew is written first in the Hebrew dialect, as the tradition said, then it's translated into Greek, and then according to St. Augustine, Mark epitomizes Matthew. So Mark, Augustine calls Mark a lackey, an abbreviator of Matthew. And in this version, then, Mark's gospel sort of takes out of Matthew's what's fundamentally necessary, kind of a Reader's Digest version. And, you know, it's much briefer, takes out all kinds of stuff. It's a sort of a cash and carry version of the gospel. You know, it's not as cumbersome. Well, this solution is appealing because it's simple, because it agrees with church tradition, and because it apparently accounts for what many regard as the more Jewish character of Matthew's gospel. Of course, Matthew is first because it's more Jewish, right? So if something is more Jewish, then it must be earlier than that which is Gentile. But this is a tremendous misunderstanding, which I will correct in a moment. And if I don't in a moment, I will in a later lecture. But the second problem with this theory is that it leaves out Luke. How did Luke get into the mix if Mark was simply abbreviating Matthew? The Griesbach hypothesis, named for J.J. Griesbach, who in 1783 first published a synopsis. So Griesbach is the person who first printed the synoptic gospels in parallel columns. He postulated that Matthew is the first, so this is a version of that, and that Luke used Matthew in the composition of his gospel. So now we have Matthew first, Luke dependent on Matthew. How does Mark get in? Aha! Mark epitomizes both. So now we have two sources that Mark is drawing from in order to create his gospel. Now, at the level of a Rubik's Cube or at the level of mathematics, this works. It certainly is possible that all of the issues of language, of material, and of sequence could be answered by Mark having established his sequence on the basis of these two prior sources. However, although it convinces some mathematically, it doesn't convince the majority of people at the moral level or at the intellectual level for a number of reasons, specifically four or five. It's actually not simpler. When it comes right down to it, it demands multiple versions. Matthew has to be written in Hebrew, then it has to be written in Greek. Luke's gospel is so obviously different than Matthew's that we have to invoke a proto-Luke, you know, two versions of Luke's gospel. So what appears to be very simple ends up being extremely complex. The Jewish character of Matthew is not because Matthew is an eyewitness and early. Rather, Matthew's Judaism is simply a different kind of Judaism, namely rabbinic Judaism, which is actually later than the Judaism of the time of Jesus. But the other three reasons are the more significant. First of all, for me, it's absolutely incomprehensible how Luke could have gotten his gospel by using Matthew. So that, you know, you have, it is so entirely different. And I, again, you must rely upon our later reading to see exactly how different Luke is than Matthew. That's hard to understand. Secondly, why would Mark leave out all the choice goodies? If Mark had two versions of the Lord's Prayer, why wouldn't he include one? You know, if Mark had two versions of the sons, why couldn't he have included one? Why would Mark leave out the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, you know, Lazarus, all the choice bits that Christians have loved, Mark apparently chose not to include, which is very difficult to understand. But the final reason is really probative. And again, it comes down to the Greek. When you read the three versions side by side, it is always possible to determine why Matthew saw a problem in Mark and corrected it one way, and why Luke saw the same problem and corrected it another way. In other words, Mark's Greek is not very good. And so it is like a pretty bad freshman composition, which two teachers are correcting, but they have different ideas about how to correct it. Now this makes, if you read passage after passage after passage in Greek, this becomes utterly convincing. Turn it around, however. How likely is it for somebody to have Dante and Shakespeare in front of him and write gibberish? It becomes very incomprehensible if you've got two well-written Greek texts in front of you, why you would render them more barbarically than your sources. It seems to me, you know, fairly easy simply to copy appropriate prose. So the majority of scholars today adopt what is called the two-source hypothesis, sometimes called the four-source. Mark is first. Matthew and Luke use Mark's gospel independently as a written source, independently correcting what they consider inferior Greek. Matthew and Luke both use another written source, conventionally designated as Q, from the German word Kella, which is mainly made up of sayings material. And then Matthew and Luke each have independent sources, or compose distinctive material called M and L. Now the value of this hypothesis, and it does remain a hypothesis, is that it best explains two phenomena in particular. The first is the phenomenon of the sequence. Matthew and Luke agree with the sequence in Mark only when they both follow Mark. And when they're not following Mark, they each go their own way. And secondly, the linguistic phenomena. As I've already explained, it really is understandable if you know Greek and you read Mark to move from Mark's version to Matthew's improvements and from Mark's versions to Luke's version. But the hypothesis is also limited. It doesn't cover every case. There are exceptions, which is why the 15% can continue to make their noises. And above all, one must be very careful not to reify Q or to, you know, act as though we actually have that material in a separate source. It is only hypothetical. It is a scholarly conclusion rather than a real document.